welcome to another episode of Show Me Your Titles. I'm Erin Donovan in San Francisco.
And I'm Kathy Dela Cruz in San Diego.
Today is our douchebags episode. We'll be reviewing Maid of Honor, Dance Party USA, and The Obscure Object of Desire.
Oh, you proposed and I accepted.
Wow, it's beautiful.
If you're getting married, I'd expect to be your best man. Tom, will you be my maid of honor?
You're maid of honor.
Oh, what is it with you, man?
I didn't.
Maid of honor.
You might have to do this. You'd be a confidant.
You'll be able to help me pick out something for the wedding night.
No.
What are you looking at?
Nothing.
You got a better chance of stopping this wedding from inside than from another continent.
Kathy, why don't you get us started with the super hit, Maid of Honor?
All right. Well, first up is douchebag number one, Maid of Honor, Patrick Dempsey's character, whose name I can't remember, Tom. Anyway, Maid of Honor revolves around...
It is Tom. I did some research. His name is Tom.
Maid of Honor revolves around Tom and Hannah, who have been platonic friends for about 10 years. He's a serial dater while she wants marriage but hasn't found Mr. Right. Just as Tom is starting to think that he is relationship material after all, Hannah goes and gets engaged. When she asks Tom to be her maid of honor, he reluctantly agrees just so he can attempt to stop the wedding and woo her. Erin, the tagline for this film is, "It takes a real man to become a maid of honor." Do you think it takes a real man to destroy his best friend's relationship for his own selfish desires?
Can we talk about how this is the second time in a month Kathy has made us review a movie that is a side project for an actor from Grey's Anatomy being a gigantic douchebag ruining someone's wedding that they care about?
I think it's time that the world knows.
I think our listeners are standing in awe of my brilliant observation there.
I think it's time our listeners found out that I am a closeted Grey's Anatomy... I almost said Gay's Anatomy fan. I am a closeted Grey's Anatomy fan.
I don't think you're really never in the closet for me, Kathy. What was the question? First of all, that is a terrible play on words, and I was very irritated to learn that this movie is not a romantic comedy about the mob. Maid of Honor. M-A-D-E.
It's a really terrible play on words. And the weirdest thing is, it doesn't make any sense, like, in the context of the film. Not even because I hate it. Like, even if I think if I had a lobotomy and enjoyed this film, I would still be like, that title doesn't make any sense. It really doesn't.
Frances Farmer does not approve.
Frances Farmer does not approve. Okay, so I won't spend much time on this because our audience probably hates this film or saw this film and hated this film, or we'll see it on an airplane soon and will at least have heard me talk about it.
And we'll consider jumping.
And we'll consider jumping. Don't do it. So first off, I mean, yes, Erin, I mean, I don't even want to ask you anything about this film, actually, but, the writing and story, I mean, it's beyond terrible. It's written by not one, not two, but three people.
Boo people.
And one of whom is credited beforehand only as writing the 2001 MTV Music Video Awards.
Oh, wow.
And the other writers are actually a pretty promising husband and wife team, which reminds me of another film that had a husband and wife team, The Nanny Diaries, that completely jumped out the window and put itself back together and tried to be a movie, which is Deborah Kaplan and her partner, Harry Elfant, who did Can't Hardly Wait and Josie and the Pussycats.
Those are great movies.
Yeah, they wrote and directed those, and then they wrote together with that horrible other guy this film, but did not direct it. So
how's the story, Kathy?
I mean, I just can't even believe it. It's just such a mess. To say it's formulaic, I mean, is an understatement. There's no point in even talking about the story. It's so horrible. It really is like, it's like a skit. It's like Ben Stiller doing something for 10 minutes on the MTV Video Music Awards, like pretending to be Tom Cruise. Like, that's pretty much the level of this.
Those were funny.
Yeah, okay, except not as funny as that. I mean, the politics are, like, beyond disturbing. So remember how last week I felt like Sex and the City had these, like, little pro-Hillary moments?
Yes.
This film had, I think, probably some very overt anti-Hillary moments.
Boo!
Yes. The opening scene, the opening sequence of this film is probably like 15 minutes of the main characters and how they met back in college like a decade ago. And it's Halloween or a masquerade party or something. And Patrick Dempsey's character is Bill Clinton, and he's trying to have sex with the person who's dressed up as Monica Lewinsky. They're joking about a cigar. It's just totally disgusting and so completely... I mean, the timing of this joke for this movie, it's just really gross, I think. Extra gross. And then there's a character with a Hillary Clinton mask on who's just like this, you know, crazy monster gross character as well. And it just felt really... I was like, wow, I'm in for this really conservative, gross, romantic comedy, aren't I? More so than I thought. I just knew it from the beginning. And something we'll see in another film that we watched, there's even this kind of like, I felt like it teetered on the line of like college frat, like date rape joking, if that makes sense. Like something about like, you know, a passed out girl. And it just didn't feel very good, even though no sex actually occurred. It just felt like women were not treated very well from the start of this film. And, I feel like I'm seeing a lot in mainstream pop culture this year that a woman running for a position of power evokes very strong feelings one way or the other. And, sometimes it's subtle, sometimes it's quite overt. Anyway, this character in this film has absolutely no honor in any sort of way. It's just this joke, this horrible movie. He sleeps with lots of girls, lots and lots of girls. Has a rule where he doesn't see a woman two nights in a row, as it means they're dating, so he doesn't do that. Mm. And of course, all these women are blonde women he treats badly, and he's got this one brunette friend played by the actress that Aaron and I really liked in Gone Baby Gone.
And in other things,
Michelle Monaghan. Who's smart, but also in love with him, and he won't sleep with her. He refuses to sleep with her, even though she's expressed interest in the past, because he feels like, you know, it will ruin things. They won't be able to be friends, and he'll basically hate her.
Why would he hate her?
Because, I mean, he doesn't respect the woman he sleeps with.
I do agree, girlfriend. It will ruin the friendship. Don't do it.
Anyway, I just felt like this film over and over was just reiterating, women don't want men who treat them nice. They want the ones who treat them terribly. And yeah, that's pretty much it. And the women in this film, even the smart ones, still want the really awful guys. It's just this awful thing. I kept reading that this film was like the male equivalent of My Best Friend's Wedding, a film that I know you don't like, Aaron, but as far as romantic comedies go, I feel like it's a pretty decent one.
No wonder you thought 27 Dresses was not a complete abortion of a film.
Oh. Hey, I don't like abortion being used as an insult here.
Ugh. You think, like, it's just acceptable, like, oh, they're friends and the whole movie is about her, him trying to spoil his friend's or her friend's wedding?
Yeah, well, I guess that would mean for me to think that weddings actually mean something when I think that...
Oh my God. Oh my God.
Yeah, so, I mean, I don't
see... They mean something to the people having them, Kathy.
Perhaps.
And they should mean something to their friends.
I mean...
Ugh. No. This is the worst thing ever.
I can
easily say without having seen this film.
Yeah, I hated this film. I can't believe I saw it. I saw it because I had the equivalent of a layover, except I was driving and couldn't get out in rush hour and ended up seeing this film. It was me and one other woman watching this film, and the usher came up to us and said, "What, you couldn't get your husbands to come with you to see this film?" And then laughed. And then I wanted to kill him. And... and of course everyone in this film is extremely rich. Patrick Dempsey's character is the ultimate douche who only got rich after he created coffee sleeves for hot cups of coffee.
Oh, God.
Yeah, and then he becomes infuriated and emasculated over and over when he realizes his best friend's fiance not only has a bigger penis, is better at sports than him, but is also much richer than him and is actually royalty. The poor guy. I mean, how can he go on living?
Oh, my God. He should just kill himself.
Yeah. And then Michelle Monaghan's character. I mean, for a woman who has... She's supposed to be a top shot at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and she just has no brains and absolutely no personality in this film. Like, none whatsoever. It's all Patrick Dempsey's character. And, yeah. And the movie essentially ends with... The male S-L-U-T getting the virgin character, basically getting, the Michelle Monaghan character, and them consummating their relationship in bed. And after they've gotten married, after he's stolen her and ruined, you know, the wedding, it just felt really gross because he's just like this vile character throughout the film. And then he gets what he wants at the end, which we're going to see in a couple of other films that we talk about today. Yeah, and just to mention a few more things really quickly, I swear. The director of this film, Paul Weiland, I think he's the definition of a terrible director. I mean, Aaron, he's directed about a dozen films, and the best of them is probably City Slickers Part 2.
Ooh. Yes. What happens in City Slickers 2? That cow must be fully grown by then.
Norman. Anyway.
Oh, yep. Remember the guy's twin plays? Oh my God, what's that actor's? Oh my God, I like City Slickers. I probably like the second one. I can't remember anyway. Anything about it.
And then the acting. I hate to say it, but I normally like Patrick Dempsey okay on, you know, television. But here he's just, I mean, I just lost a lot of respect for him. I can't believe I had any, but I mean, this is just such a horrible part. It's such a horrible film. Michelle Monaghan was just, I mean, she was so tough and strong in Gone Baby Gone, the last film we saw her in. Mm-hmm. And here she's like this unconscious love interest the whole time with like, you know, this kind of just deer in headlights look to her the whole time. And the only saving grace are the supporting characters, of course, played by Kadeem Hardison of A Different World fame.
Dwayne Wayne.
And as his best friend, and Busy Phillips as her best friend. She's amazing. She's the best part of this movie. She's, like, the only, like, she's the only hint of a strong female character.
Is she the Judy Greer in this film?
She's, like, Judy Greer, but a really tough, scary Judy Greer.
Nice.
And, the thing about her is I loved her. She's the only one that puts the main character in his place for being a jerk. And then, of course, she becomes this drunk psycho who, after hating him for the entire movie, gets drunk and wants to have sex with him.
I guess it's better than what I would have been expecting, that she, like, gets drunk and is raped and then murdered or something.
No, actually, Aaron. She actually tries to sexually assault him. It actually gets... I'm not kidding. It was one of the strangest things I've seen in a film. She, like, really almost forces him to have sex.
Okay,
it's really
here's
intense.
Another issue I'm having with this film. Do we buy Patrick Dempsey as a Casanova type of figure?
Yeah, that's... I mean, that's what he is on Grey's Anatomy.
I mean, he's
as
just
well.
Always going to be the dork from Can't Buy Me Love for me.
Yeah.
On the lawnmower, remember?
Oh, yeah, and I hate to say this, but this was Sydney Pollack's last film.
I know, very sad.
I've read some reviews before he passed away that said he's the only tiny bit of soul in this film. And he actually plays a big misogynist in this film.
Oh.
But I mean, he's a funny misogynist, but a misogynist no less.
I think we should just remember Sydney Pollack's last role as being the great doctor in The Sopranos, who was very good in that role. And he's even great. He was great in Michael Clayton. We've reviewed now three Sydney Pollack films. How nice is that?
We have. Rest in peace, Sydney.
We love you, Sydney.
And what we don't love is Maid of Honor. See it only if you're like a freshman in college in a women's studies class and have to write a paper on a really sexist film. Otherwise, don't see it.
You know what I think about sometimes, man?
What?
Like, okay, like before something happens, like there's a chance for anything, you know? Tell you what, let me start over, like, from scratch, okay?
Aaron. Can you tell us about our next film, which sounds so fun based on its title, Dance Party USA?
Hey guys, Dance Party USA is the 2006 directorial debut of Aaron Katz, one of the most prominent figures in the quote-unquote mumblecore film movement. This film centers on two suburban teenagers, Gus and Jessica, who meet at a party and form a fast connection when he makes a startling confession. Clocking in at about 60 minutes, that's really the long and the short of what happens in this film. Kathy, were you moved by either the setting, confession, or progression of this relationship?
Yes, I was.
Me too.
I didn't know what Dance Party USA was about at all. I just had heard decent things about Open City, Aaron Katz's next film. I'm sorry, what's it called?
Quiet City.
Quiet City. I don't know why I thought it was called Open City.
There's a famous film called Open City.
Okay.
I can see the cover in my mind.
Okay, well, I heard a lot of really good things about his follow-up to this, a feature film called Quiet City. And conveniently enough, the two come on one DVD together, or in one DVD package at least.
Yeah.
So
it's a two-disc DVD package.
And it's kind of a beautiful DVD package, I have to say.
It really is. Good job, Benton Films. I wasn't being sarcastic. It's real. Like, it's an upstart DVD distributor named Benton Films.
Yeah, I love the way you said it. It was your eyes. I could tell your eyes got big from across.
Because I've become very invested in DVD packaging in the last month or so. So I noticed these things and I was very impressed with the... And it was their first release, Benton Films, the dance... No, it wasn't. It was their second, but beautiful.
What was their first release?
LOL, the Joe Swanberg film.
I still haven't seen that.
Okay.
But I liked the writing and directing by Aaron Katz here a lot. This film, I've said, you know, I say this and I hope the audience understands what I mean, but I feel like it's a simple film, and I don't mean that in a bad way. I just think it's a simple, quiet film, and it feels real in a way that, you know, a film like Kids just doesn't to me, and I feel like they're trying to do similar things, and one is just kind of like all just kind of like cuss words and shock value, and the other's kind of like there's some shock value, but it's the most kind of
there's some shock value, yeah.
Yeah, but it's kind of in this very still, quiet... It's almost like someone is whispering to you something, which is similar to what actually happens in the movie, telling you something, and you don't really know how to respond. That's kind of what this film is like for me.
It seems like it's very much like how secrets come out in real relationships.
Yeah, totally.
And I wrote in my notes, confirms all of my scary middle-class white girl suburban paranoia. Children are terrible. Should be kept in cages.
Well, yeah.
And also, this film totally supports my theory that within every circle of dude friends, there is one rapist. No matter what station of life or how great they seem, there's one rapist in every bunch.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know what the statistic on that is, but isn't it like one in every four women is sexually assaulted?
In her lifetime. So yes, it makes sense that, like, say, one in 10 men would be a rapist.
This douchebag episode is going to be quite the hot tamale, I feel like. We're just making up statistics now and calling men douchebags. Yeah.
That's a game I play sometimes on the bus. Like, if it's really crowded, I'll be like, one of these men is a rapist.
It's a really fun game to play, especially at night when you're alone. But, anyway, this film is really intense, and this would be, you know, Gus would be douchebag number two. And he is a douchebag.
Yeah.
He is. But I enjoy this film. Because I don't think that the filmmaker is a douchebag.
No.
Maid of Honor.
Oh.
You know, it's intense, because I feel like it's this hour-long film, but it's really simple. But at the same time, like, I'm left with all these questions, like, and they're not questions about the film. Like, there's nothing I'm confused about the film, but they're questions about my relationship as a viewer to the film. And, you know, what does it mean when, you know, the main character of a film, is a rapist, like, and he's the protagonist and he's got to go on with his life. And
we see things through his, you know, perspective, and he's kind of going on with his life.
Yeah, and it's a really interesting setup here, I feel. It kind of surprised me, what was going on.
Yeah, I really like this film too, and I thought it was so intense at times that I felt like if I had seen this in the theater, I might have gotten a little nauseous. I know a lot of things make me nauseous in the movie theater, and intensity is one of them. I'm glad I watched this on DVD.
It was funny. I was thinking, I was like, I wonder how the filmmaker came up with this plot line, because it's just so, it doesn't feel like something someone made up out of thin air. It feels like something that really happened, you know? It just has that feeling. Mm-hmm.
Maybe someone in his dude circle of friends told him about?
No, I read an interview with him, and he said that, you know, he was living in Portland, Oregon without a car, and he was on the bus, and he heard these two guys on the bus, you know, talking about stuff, and he just, you know, thought it was disgusting. He said, but he couldn't stop, like, writing it down because it was so bizarre, and he wanted, you know, maybe use it for something. And then he said that same summer, you know, I don't think necessarily on a bus, but he heard two girls having a conversation and, you know, just thought, what if I put these two different conversations together to make a film? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think it's an interesting way to go about writing, and not interesting necessarily, because I feel like plenty of people write down conversations they overhear, but it's nice to hear that that's the approach he took to make this film.
Yeah. You know, I just went to a book reading of Michael Chabon, and he was talking, am I saying that right? Michael Chabon?
Yeah.
I think so. And he was talking about how, and this is actually something my writing professors at Evergreen used to say, you're not a writer unless you read and live. And I also get a lot of my ideas on the bus, so I like that too. eavesdropping on people's conversations.
Totally.
And picking
it's
out
scary
rapists.
To be eavesdropped on, though, which I've had happen to me. Mm. But and another thing, Aaron, for me is like, I mean, I can't watch this and, you know, think to myself, how can I, as like a feminist film reviewer, or a feminist watching this film, how can I feel about the happy ending? Like, how can I say I liked this film when the happy ending is pretty disturbing?
You know,
go on.
Watching this movie, I was really surprised by how much it reminded me of Paranoid Park. Dance Party USA came up a few years before Paranoid Park, I want to make clear here, but they both take place in Portland. They're both about young men who do something horrible, and then we just spend a lot of time watching them, like, feel bad and moving on with their lives, and they never reach a point where they decide to take any responsibility for what they've done. And I really liked Dance Party USA a lot more. Like, I hated Paranoid Park. I think I might have called you and started complaining about it randomly after
you
I
did.
Saw it.
You had just seen that, and
Frownland as a double feature. God help us all. But this, I think Gus Van Sant is just sort of a problematic director in a lot of ways that just isn't at all at issue here. I don't know. I get what you're talking about in terms of feeling very weird about watching this kid have a life, but you know, I kind of like that about it, that it's just about like this seemingly normal kid who's just very average and did something horrible and then is gonna like go on with his life. And you know, while I was watching it, at least I was thinking about like, well, so what? Like, what happens when this kid gets to college and he, you know, has this in him that he can do this sort of thing? And you know, what so what? Like, what is he gonna do with his life? I feel like in both films we're sort of invited to be glad that they realized what they did was wrong, that they're not gonna do it again, but like that doesn't do anything for me, frankly.
Yeah.
In terms of these were people I knew, like in this film, I think it works fine.
Yeah. And I went in watching this film and had no idea what it was going to be about whatsoever. And, you know, the longer it's been since I saw it, which was, you know, about a month ago, maybe, it's really become kind of more disturbing to me, like the more I think about it. And
in a good way.
Yeah, I mean, I like the film, but I wouldn't say it becomes disturbing in a good way. I like the film, and it's disturbing. But it kind of reminds me of...
It's disturbing, you know, in a way the filmmaker intended, I guess is what I meant by that.
I believe so, yes. But it reminds me of a couple of different cinematic relationships. It reminds me most recently of Vincent Gallo and Christina Ricci in Buffalo 66. Mm-hmm. There's something about their relationship that, I mean, but then it also reminds me of definitely of like a, you know, Godard, like Pierrot Le Fou relationship.
Why?
And I mean, there's definitely something about these male-female relationships where, you know, the male is doing something that's kind of taking control from the female, but we're still going, but he's not a bad guy exactly in the eyes of the filmmaker or the way that it's being played out. And I feel like we're going to see that in another film that we talk about today too, and have a lot to say.
Maybe again. But,
what?
Maybe.
And it's funny because I honestly think what, you know, these characters are doing in a film like Dance Party USA is actually, I mean, a lot more despicable than what someone is doing in Maid of Honor, but the filmmaking is so much better in one that it somehow makes it, it makes it a whole different experience to watch. I mean, I guess I just feel like, you know, both men are really despicable in these films, but one is just someone that sleeps around and one is actually a rapist. Mm-hmm. Yet the film about the rapist, it's handled so much better than it is about just the guy that doesn't respect women.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's really the big difference between these films.
Yeah, this one doesn't feel anti-woman. And I think it's because the female character, Jessica, is a very strong, relatable figure.
Yeah, I like her a lot in this film. I like her a lot. And, yeah. The acting in this film is definitely is something I liked. I don't think these people had necessarily been in films. I guess the only one I think that's been in films before this was the young girl that plays Christy. Mm-hmm. I think she's been in a few things. But that one scene where hopefully our audiences will rent this and check it out, but, where the main character asks his best male friend for a hug is completely amazing.
I know.
I was like, Gus Van Sant, you're like how old now and you can't make a scene work like this. And this young director can.
Yeah, Gus Van Sant should watch Dance Party USA and go to school. Because seriously, Paranoid Park is a hot mess. And this film is great.
And then, no wonder I like Aaron Katz. I feel like he's totally... he has some really good film taste. He really likes Buster Keaton, Ozu, and Jacques Tati.
Okay.
Just want to say that. Yeah, anyway... I just want to say, I like the cinematography. I thought the editing was good. I have to say the opening sequence of this film is really different from the rest of the film, and I really, really like it. Where the main female character just kind of wanders around this party she's woken up in mm-hmm. the morning after. And I feel like after seeing the entire film, that opening becomes a lot more haunting, I feel. Once you learn what the film is about, and really it's a really intense movie, and it came out of left field that it was going to be so intense.
Yeah. And I have to say that opening scene is very similar to how Medicine for Melancholy opens. And I feel like these two films together have really restored my faith in the ultra low budget filmmaking movement known as mumblecore, maybe just ultra low budget filmmaking in general and specifically not mumblecore.
Yeah, this film is made for $3,000.
Yeah. All right.
Anyway, I highly recommend it. Aaron, were you able to check out the other Aaron Katz film that came with this?
No.
I enjoyed that film, too. It's quite different. It's definitely on the kind of
indie
romance.
They're on two separate DVDs, right? I didn't rent this one and forget to watch Quiet City, did I?
Yeah, they're on two separate... Okay. They're on two separate DVDs, but... If you're using an actual video store that you go to person, then you get the better deal because you rent them together.
Hmm.
Just saying.
You can rent two DVDs for the same price as one?
Yeah.
Wow, no wonder that's a floundering business model.
Oh.
Well, the single DVD that I rented from an anonymous online rental provider was a great DVD, not just the packaging, but... It included two commentary tracks, as well as extended and deleted scenes, and the director's short film. I love it when they do that.
I have to say, I wasn't super into the director's short films, but enjoyed the other film that I saw with the feature film, Quiet City, which is definitely on the indie romance side of things as opposed to the scary teen date rape side of things.
Teenagers are so scary, and they should all just be rounded up and kept somewhere until they are finished with puberty.
OMG. Okay, well, we recommend Dance Party USA and Quiet City.
Une petite culotte, monsieur. Au feu, c'est tout mouillé.
Je donnerais volontiers quelque chose pour connaître l'origine de votre geste.
Vous êtes bien curieux, monsieur.
Je suis professeur de psychologie.
Et les parties pieds nus. Elle a saigné.
Ce n'est rien, c'est le nez.
Dehors, tous les deux. Je te donne 10 minutes. Sinon, on appelle la police et on l'embarque.
All right. Kathy, you want to tell us a little something about Obscure Object of Desire?
Yes, which I keep calling the obscure object of my desire, which I think says something scary about me. But the obscure object of desire is famed auteur Luis Buñuel's 1977 film set in Spain and France against a backdrop of a terrorist insurgency where the plot follows a man just after boarding a train and, much to the surprise of his fellow passengers, pours a bucket of water over a young, beat-up woman on the platform. Over the next few hours, the older man explains, and the audience sees in flashback, how the man became obsessed by the younger woman, who is played by two different actresses, which we will discuss later, and how she was the obscure object of his desire. The film, while not financially successful, was nominated for both Academy and Golden Globe awards at the time of its release. Erin, you described the film to me as pretty anti-feminist and even kind of racist, but I have to say I feel kind of differently about this film. Upon reviewing this film, or maybe alongside the other films we talked about in today's podcast, are you still viewing The Obscure Object of Desire pretty negatively?
I'm sure I never said it was anti-feminist. I'm sure I did say it was racist, and I definitely still stand by that characterization, although I have to say I still liked it. I find a few things deeply problematic about it, but there's still plenty to like in it as well.
Yes. I like this film too. Do you realize that this is, I believe this is Luis Buñuel's last film that he directed?
Really?
I'm pretty sure it is, 1977. I mean, he was directing films forever, so I think this is his last film as a director.
Hmm. Well, sayonara, Buñuel.
It's written by him and his longtime collaborator, Jean-Claude Carrière, whose name I probably slaughtered. And then it's based on the French novel from the late 1800s, I believe, which basically, I'm not even going to try and pronounce it because I'm very sad, but it basically translates to The Woman and the Puppet. Which I guess has been it. This is not the first time it's been adapted for the screen. Joseph von Sternberg also made it into a film called The Devil is a Woman with Marlene Dietrich.
Oh my God.
Yes.
That's hilarious.
Why is that hilarious?
Because I've seen that movie. That's amazing. They came from the same source material.
Oh, they did. Anyway, I enjoyed this film, Erin. I'm glad that you recommended we review it for douche number 3.
This guy's actually, in this case, it's the director, I feel, that made some douchey decisions. I actually kind of like the man in this movie.
Fernando Rey.
I think that actor is just extremely appealing. And I love what I think really, we'll get to what, I mean, is pretty obvious that what I didn't like about this movie. But I think what I really did enjoy about this movie is that it's this young woman who I think we're supposed to believe is maybe like out of school or something recently and doesn't have a lot of money. And then this older man who is very sexually attracted to her and has a lot of money. And so it's this relationships that just, it has a lot of inequity just built into it. And I love the give and take between these two people that like, they're both constantly trying to control each other, but neither of them ever really have control of themselves or the other person. And I like that it seems very intimate in this way that, you know, it would be very easy for us to dismiss this relationship as outsiders, but there's always something different happening in a relationship than you can always convey to people. And I think this film really illustrates that very well.
I would agree with you.
And the scenes in the train where he's flashing forward to telling the story are hilarious. Like, they're just very, like, sitcom-y funny. And I love that. Well, I love the ending. Let's not spoil the ending, but I love the ending of this film.
Of course you do. I didn't realize this was such late 70s Buñuel until I popped it into the DVD player, but I'm really scared of, like, the time period that it came from, 77.
Bounce, chicka, bounce, bounce.
So close to the 80s that I really like.
Are you afraid of the 80s?
I like the closer to the 60s side of the 70s.
Okay.
But I was definitely into this film. I guess what I really liked about this film was that it was just such a great look at this really extreme male expression of sexual frustration. I really kept thinking that it was really, like, no different from someone like Catherine Breillat making Romance, you know, in the last 10 years as an expression of female sexual frustration.
But with no period sex scenes in this movie.
You are obsessed with talking about period sex scenes.
I am obsessed with how much I do not enjoy seeing period sex scenes in movies, yes.
Wow, that is so funny. I'm not going to make any comments about this because this is a PG-13 rated podcast. But anyway, I just...
Okay.
Yeah. But anyway, yeah, I just kept thinking... well, before I thought that maybe you thought this film was really kind of misogynistic. So I kept thinking, well, you know, it's funny how I feel like people consider something... A lot of people consider Romance kind of this, like, feminist take on male-female sexual relations. And so it was funny to me that what I would consider the male equivalent might be considered misogynistic. And so I was like, how is the reverse of, like, feminism misogyny?
I think you're just buying into that thing where, like, anytime a woman doesn't like something, it's because it's quote-unquote anti-feminist. I actually
thought that you said it was misogynistic. That's why. Misogynist. Why do I keep saying misogynistic? I've made up that word.
Because you like to say istic.
I do like to say istic. Anyway, I think the woman in this film, the one that you have some problems with, the fact that she's playing what you believe the more sexualized woman in the film. I actually think she's the tougher woman in the film. And I don't think it's to me that she's this super, like, sexualized being, because...
Let's present a little context for this, because the reason this role is played by two different actresses is because Buñuel cast this very, like, you know, slender, pale French, very stereotypical French waif looking woman to play this role. And she decided at some point during the production that she didn't want to do, there's a lot of nudity in the movie, and she didn't want to do it. And she couldn't talk him out of, like, having those scenes, which, I mean, seeing this movie as a whole, it's hard to imagine in script form how you could take nudity out of this movie, but okay. So instead of she left, and instead of recasting it and reshooting the scenes with this woman in it, he just cast a totally different looking woman who is a very typical Spanish looking actress. And she's only there to do, like, basically the nude scenes. And I mean, it's a good 50% of it. So it's not like she's a partial character.
See, I completely disagree with this. Like, I watched this film and I completely disagree. I feel like,
Can I finish the observation here?
Yes.
A lot of people have attributed this as being some sort of, like, really fascinating artsy fartsy choice, but really it was a budgetary choice. And I feel like part of, like, my angst about it is that it's just completely misconstrued by film historians.
I don't, cause you heard this from the DVD. Yes.
Yeah.
And what I heard from the DVD was him saying that, you know, he wanted this one French actress to play the woman, and then she backed out because of the nudity, and so he got these other two actresses to do it. That was my interpretation of what he was saying. And so I think, you know, we both heard him differently on the DVD. And also, I think that they both do nudity. One just happens to do the scenes where she does both, you know, top and bottom nudity, but they both do plenty of topless scenes, I feel, pretty equally.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I don't think that she is a quote-unquote, like, typical Spanish-looking actress. Like, I think she's, you know, a beautiful woman that happens to be a famous Spanish actress, and she's, like, credited as playing, like, both, like, two parts, like, herself and the actress, so I just don't know if I completely think that, like, I just don't buy that she, we never actually, the most we see is, like, a crotch shot of her. Like, I don't feel like she's really doing something that's like, we never actually see her having sex with someone or engaging in sex with someone. Like,
no, and it's not like I have a problem with the nude scenes. I just think, and I, you know, I cannot make any kind of comment on what like the cultural settings and norms were like in 1977 Spain when Buñuel made this film. But I'm just saying, watching it now, like, it is startling to see this much darker skinned, curvy, much curvier woman, like, playing, like, just the hypersexual aspects of this character, and then just the skinny little pale French woman playing all the, like, coquettish, like, oh, or, like, jilted lover scenes. Like, it's just, it's very shocking to me, and I don't like that, you know, a lot of American film students watch this film and they're just like, oh, like, what a brilliant choice. When I just see it as playing into a very problematic sexual stereotype about non-white women.
I don't,
in America.
I just don't agree with you at all. I mean, I just, I don't think she's, I think that it's not, like, I don't see it as, honestly, I think if you put their skin, like, up next to each other, I feel like they have the same skin color. Like, to say that one is much darker skin than the other, like, I just don't see that at all. I feel like one maybe has a curvier body, but they have different body types. Like, I don't feel like, I feel like, if anything, it's playing into this kind of, like, Betty Veronica type, like, sexy slash girl next door thing than I do white woman slash Spanish woman equals sexualized. Like, I don't see that. Like, I just don't see it in this film. And, you know, the filmmaker himself is Spanish, and the film takes place in Spain and France, and I just don't see it as this woman of color equals sexual object. I see both of them as playing on stereotypes. I mean, one has straight hair, one has curly hair. One, you know, I feel like it's not about the color of their skin, because I barely notice the color of their skin. Like, I just don't see that. And I feel like one is really, I don't know. I feel like they're both playing this kind of, like, I hate to say it, this, like, virgin whore type thing. And but I don't see it as, I just don't see it as the color of their skin at all. I just can't see it that way. And I just don't think it's as simple, and I'm not shocked by it at all. Like, I feel like I've seen much worse, without needing to see both types of women on screen. Like, I feel like I often see, you know, women in film naked and sexualized in a way that is deeply offensive to me. But here it's like, I'm just not offended by it. And I don't see it as that.
I guess because I don't see it as being a decision made on the outset. And maybe we can verify that from, you know, go to another source and find out about it. But I guess it's not like I don't entirely think that it's like this deeply problematic issue with Buñuel himself. I guess I see it as like the way it is interpreted in an American audience that I find just so contributing to a negative stereotype.
Yeah, I think I just have this problem with, I feel like, I just have to say, like, I feel like I'm a Mexican woman, for instance, have like curvier body. I just feel like in general, curvier body types are seen, when a woman does nudity and she has a curvier body, it's seen as like over sexualized just because she has a curvier body. And I don't know.
But the Spanish actress is also doing all of the like full nude scenes. Like, there's like plenty of scenes where she's just naked, like in the scene for like a prolonged period of time, you know, because she's a stripper, because like she's making love with another man, or, you know, or having sex with someone in front of this man that she's trying to spite. Like,
and all of those sex scenes, we don't actually see them. They're like off screen. We see her about to have sex, but we don't actually see the sex.
Well, we see her stripping.
See her stripping, but I mean, it's from far away. Like, I feel like it's pretty tasteful as far as a stripping scene in this film can be.
Right, and I mean, I want to make this sound like it's some X-rated film, but I mean, the Spanish woman is doing like a lot more nudity than the French actress.
I don't know. I just feel like she happens to do a couple of below the belt nude scenes, like a couple. Like, I don't feel like...
I mean, can we recall a scene where the Spanish actress is clothed? Because I can't.
Are you kidding? She's clothed in like most of the movie. Like, she's totally clothed. I think you should watch it again. I mean,
I think she's only in the scenes that required nudity. That's what I recall from watching this movie not that long ago. So
it's not. Maybe. I don't believe that's true. I believe that they're both nude. And I was watching it expecting to see that, like, anytime I saw the Spanish woman come in, I'd be like, okay, there's going to be a sex scene, and it wouldn't happen. I mean, this movie is about sexual frustration, and...
And I had made you very sexually frustrated because you were expecting so much sex.
Yes, it's true. Well, anyway, we should probably get off this subject because we just, I think, disagree, and that's it.
Okay.
But, I mean, I think it's an interesting thing to talk about, and I think that we should both do some more research and then have an official debate, and it can be live on the podcast.
Or not. Aaron, I still recommend the film. Like, I really like the story. I just really love, like, and my skin just crawled at this one aspect of it.
Yeah. Anyway, I think that this film definitely influenced both David Lynch's Mulholland Drive and Wes Anderson's Darjeeling Limited.
Okay.
I just
because there's see a that train.
Well, the train definitely. I just see it in a big way in that, and I feel like it was definitely. You hear me say this, I know, but I feel like it was completely influenced by Pierrot Le Fou. I do.
I know you do.
You know, I think this was the first Buñuel film I've ever seen that was in color.
Really?
Yes. Yeah, I thought the acting was great. I mean, these are three great actors: Fernando Rey, Carol Bouquet, and Angela Molina as Conchita. Cinematography, beautiful. Can I ask you, do we know about Buñuel's editor? He's worked with this person before. They have a name. I'm sure it's probably a man, but their name is Helene, and I just wonder if it's possible that she was a female editor.
I have no idea.
If anyone knows, that's my big question. Was Helene Plemnikov a male or female?
Oh, my Lord. You know what's funny? I rented a Louis Buñuel documentary a couple weeks ago, and it didn't have any English subtitles. I was very disappointed. Maybe I could answer your question had there been subtitles on that DVD.
Did you see a woman cutting some film in there?
No, I was just like, my Spanish is not this good, and turned it off.
Anyway, I like this film. I'm glad I saw it.
Me too. Now if a dude tells me he really likes this movie, I'm going to be on guard. I'm a little bit on guard now. But we hope that you will see Obscure Object of Desire and then get in touch with us and let us know what the hell was going on with this movie, with the two actresses. You can do so at showmeyourtitles@gmail.com.
Or you can leave us comments and tell us there. And also PayPal us, because we really need to support our ever-growing bandwidth at www.showmeyourtitles.com.
It's true. So have a great week, everybody.
Don't be a douchebag.
Best advice ever.